Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest now is Dr. Rebecca Thompson, who has a brand new book out that I absolutely had to read and talk to her about. It's Fire, Ice, and Physics, The Science of Game of Thrones. So we get to talk about all sorts of scientific examinations of what we saw in Game of Thrones. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for having me.
You have no idea. I love books like this because you're bringing a fantastical world, a creation out of some author or some filmmaker's mind, and you're picking out the parts. How can this be done in our real world? How, you know, what would this look like in real life? And that attention to detail, that application of physics, science, chemistry, biology, all of that fun science stuff that I enjoyed in high school, we're applying it to the television shows I'm addicted to. And that just makes my life worthwhile.
Well, I had a heck of a lot of fun writing it.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm going to go through the table of contents so people know exactly how deep this dive is. We have Seasons in Westeros, The Science Behind the Ice Wall, How to Survive in the Cold North of the Wall, White Walkers, Zombies, Parasites, and Statistics, which is something I really want to ask about. You have a chapter on regular steel made in Pittsburgh, Valyrian steel made in Damascus. And as somebody who also watches way too much Forged in Fire, I have questions. Dragon biology. Bats with fire. the physics of dragonglass. The melting of Harrenhal. The science of wildfire. The genetics of the family trees Targaryen and Lannister, since they have few branches. and gruesome deaths. The science of the sea and gruesome deaths. And I think there's a death in there that you missed, so we'll talk about that later.
I will. That was a rough chapter to write. I gave myself nightmares. So
Ooh.
If I missed it, I probably thought about it and decided I couldn't do it.
Well, we'll talk about that when we get to it. But the you talked about making the ice wall and analyzing the steel when we were talking before. For you, what was all right? First, let's rewind all the way back. Why did you write such a dense scientific tome on Game of Thrones?
Well, it started years ago after season two came out, and I was teaching teachers at a summer institute in Biosphere 2 in Arizona. So we're in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said, hey, do you want to give a dinner time talk? And I said, sure, on what? And they said, I don't know, whatever you want. And I wanted to do this. So I gave an hour-long talk on the science of things that I thought about during season one and two. And, you know, just kind of the questions that I came up with. Stuff like, could fire really melt stone? What is glass? Why, you know, what happens to steel when it gets cold? Just kind of quick problems like that. And I got to talk about it, and it was awesome. I did some demos. I had a bunch of teachers really excited. The thing I didn't expect is that not a single one of them had seen the show beforehand.
Oh.
So that was fun. But they all, I saw many of them, you know, the next year, and they had all gone home and become huge Game of Thrones fans. So I did something. And I loved getting to do it, and then got asked to do it again and updated it. And finally, I knew that MIT Press was interested in pop science books, and I was like, hey, I got a thing for you. And as I was trying to figure out exactly what questions to answer, I ended up spending a lot of time on fan forums. So any, you know, just basically Reddit, Quora, any place fans ask questions. And trying to figure out if there was enough that people were interested in, like what questions did they have? were they things that I could answer? Like, what was everybody thinking? And so the majority of the stuff in the book is based on the questions that I just kind of saw repeated on Twitter, like on the internet, like in anywhere you go and talk about Game of Thrones. Those were the questions that people wanted answered. And so then I was like, okay, I can do that. Like, I can absolutely answer these questions. And it was really neat to kind of explore all these different types of science, because I'm a physicist by training. And I really had to spend a lot of time with papers in chemistry or biology or medicine and understand that language and how it's different, but, you know, use my understanding of science to be able to figure out, you know, what they were saying and how they were saying it and what I needed from the paper. So it was fascinating and wonderful, but I really, more than anything, hope I answered basically the questions everyone was arguing about over a beer after the show. And that's what I wanted it to be. And the last thing I want it to be is anything nitpicky. None of it is this couldn't happen and that couldn't happen. And scene 2, episode 3, season 4, clearly that isn't a thing that could happen. It's more about just like, hey, this is some interesting scientific stuff. And you know, I had a blast writing it, so I hope people are just as excited to read it.
So how hard was it to whittle down this collection to, I guess what you have here is like 12 or 13 main sections, and each section is dedicated, like I said, to those chapters that I read out. I'm sure there were a lot more questions from fans out there than these 13.
Well, it's interesting because they all really seem to fall in those, in that section. It's like, wow, I wonder what could someone really die like that is a question that a lot of people were asking. Like, is that a way people can die? And so I had to do a chapter on that. Everybody was asking about fire, seasons, dragons. So it was interesting because even though there were a lot of individual questions, they all kind of fell in these categories. And so I think the harder part was figuring out what I specifically could and could not answer. What I could just talk about and what I could actually say, okay, this is a question that I can tell you. Like with the zombies, statistically, if you want to avoid becoming a white, this is where you want to be in Westeros based on statistics and how zombies work. And, that was interesting, figuring out that was, you know, given the research that was out there, that was a question I could answer. And I think really figuring out I think the harder part was finding ways to answer a concrete question and less like, here's some interesting things about winter, you know? So, that was fun. I think one of the really interesting things was kind of exploring my own psychology about writing stuff. So a lot of, you know, I knew I was going to just dive headfirst into all the things that make Game of Thrones, for a mature audience only. And, that to me was fascinating, like what I found uncomfortable and what I didn't care about. And like writing about incest, I was kind of like, yeah, all right, whatever. Like that's statistics. Here we go. And then writing about certain types of death, it was like fine. And then other types, like total nightmares. It was just very weird. Trying to turn off the emotion part and just be scientific about things and figuring out when I could do that and when I couldn't.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the fun parts, because the one chapter that immediately grabbed my attention and made me go, what, was about dragon biology. As soon as I read bats but with fire, I went, that's not a, wait, okay, no, wait, no, my head hurts now.
Well, so initially with that chapter, I really wanted to talk about, could a dragon fly? Like that was my ultimate question. Could a dragon fly? Mm-hmm. And what I found was that's not the only question. The question was kind of bigger than that. And it's things like, is a dragon warm-blooded or cold-blooded? And that was a hard, that was a question that needed to be answered. So it kind of expanded from just could it fly to like, what is the biology of a flighted animal? What is, you know, how do, are dragons mammals? Are dragons reptiles? What are they? And using what was available in the show to kind of figure that out. And then the chapter on Harrenhal is like, essentially, how could dragons produce fire? And if they did, what would happen? So it's kind of two, one's dragon fire, one's the rest of the dragons. But with that chapter in particular, it was interesting learning about things like how people, like, well, first off, learning about bats and how bats worked and how bats are different than birds and how bats fly differently than birds. And it's like we all kind of group them together and everyone thinks like, you know, bats are just like little fuzzy rats with wings. And bats are fascinating. The way that they, their whole wing stroke, the way that they move their wings, their entire, their bone structure, it's all completely different from birds, and really, really unique. And I loved getting a chance to learn about that. And then watching dragons, they're very, very similar to bats, but they look like reptiles. But they absolutely have to be warm-blooded because you can't fight in the north if you're cold-blooded because you'd just be really sleepy. Mm-hmm. And so it's a chance for me to talk about warm-blooded versus cold-blooded and what that means. And are there any animals that are warm-blooded with scales? And there are, but they're weird. and then, you know, obviously, okay, so instead of going at it with the question being, could a bat get that big? Which was kind of the first way I went, kind of approached the question of could a dragon fly. I decided that the easier way to look at the question is really, well, what's the largest flighted animal ever? Like, what's the largest thing that could fly that is nature made? I got to learn a lot about paleontology and about how paleontologists decided which dinosaurs, which pterosaurs were flighted and which weren't. And I thought that, you know, I didn't know how they determined this. I just, for some reason, like when you don't research it, you just assume they know. Mm-hmm. Like you just say, okay, yes, clearly this animal had wings, so it flew. But it's not that easy because there was a transition period where there were dinosaurs, there were pterosaurs that they thought that had wings that they thought only kind of glided. And then there were ones where they're like, it's kind of like the ostrich. They have wings that are for decoration. And figuring out which ones have wings and flew is kind of a really tricky thing. And there was an argument about it because one type of dinosaur looked like it should have been able to fly or looked like it had all the markers of an actual flighted pterosaur. But they didn't think its bones were strong enough. And another group was like, hey, actually, if we image the bones, it turns out their bones are strong enough. And as someone that's reading this, I'm like, wait, it's bone strength we're all concerned about? Like, I didn't even know that was the question we were going to be arguing. And so I got to learn not just like all about pterosaurs, but also that the limiting factor wasn't necessarily size or muscles. Everyone had decided the limiting factor really was bone strength. Huh. The bones had to be strong enough to push air down, creating enough lift force without breaking. And that I never would have thought that that was the question that everybody was looking at, yet that's the question everybody's looking at. So that was fascinating to me. I would have thought, you know, muscles and joints and all of this. And in reality, when paleontologists are arguing about whether or not pterosaurs were flighted, they're like, yeah, their bones aren't strong enough. Like that was their trump card, so to speak. And that, you know, that's an easy sci-fi fix. Like, we have super strong dragon bones. Okay, done. Like, problem solved.
Yeah, I would have thought it would have been strength of the joints and strength of the muscles, you know, like, I guess the equivalent of shoulders and bone length, not bone strength.
And bone strength was the limiting factor. I mean, there were dinosaurs that weighed about 500 pounds that could fly, which to me is fascinating. Just what learning what nature can do was absolutely fascinating. Wow. But Yeah. So I wanted to have a chapter where I could go into more than just the, like, here's what flight is, but a lot about the biology of an animal of that size that could fly and could fly in both the south and the north. So I wanted more space than just to say, could a dragon fly?
So how big can the dragons be? Because I'm going with the argument here. We see how big Drogon is. We heard stories told in the mythology, the history of Westeros, that Beleriand the Dread was big enough to carry an entire army on his back.
So I ended up in all the like kind of math problems I was doing to figure out what it would take. This was when I think D.B. Weiss, someone asked him, like, how big are the dragons going to get? And he's like a full-fledged 747. So I'm like, oh, cool, I can find math on that. And so all of my math and, like, weight calculations and figuring out about flight are all based on the size of your average 747. So I, like, you know, figure out the lift force needed per square meter to lift a 747 off the ground and, you know, what that would take of a dragon. So I that type of estimation is things that is something I had to do with, you know, other sections of the book as well. And just kind of guessing what, you know, just general estimation, like, well, that looks like it's about that size. Or, you know, if I look at the video again and again, that looks like it's about that. So a lot of, you know, it's a lot of that. But or if I could find one of the showrunners or one of the, you know, anything written specifically in the books, I could use that.
Were you able to go through the books and get a lot of the information you need? Because that literally is the source, the books, the original books written by George R. R. Martin, and any of the reference books written by people who worked with him in putting those histories together. And because now I'm distracted by downdrafts and takeoff forces, because the airplane can get up to, like, 400 miles an hour to take off. Dragon can't run 400 miles an hour to take off.
No, but it's a different, I mean, you're not flapping a 747.
This is true.
So it's a different lift mechanism. I mean, it's some of the same lift mechanism, but it's still, you've got a lot of different forces acting in that. So yeah, I mean, a dragon's not going to run, but its wings don't work like that.
True. Okay.
So that's the difference.
It's problem solved.
It's different. yes. But as to the question about the books, it was really funny when I decided I wanted to put together, like, the book proposal. I'm thinking about what I want to write about. And I remember sitting there in my kitchen with my boyfriend at the time, now husband. And I'm like, oh, awesome. Like, I know what I'm going to do. I need to find, and, like, I knew exactly kind of what scene I needed to find in the books. I'm like, this is great. And so I immediately do, I'm not an ebook person. So I immediately do what I usually do. And I run over to my bookshelf and I look at, like, 5,000 pages worth of books. I'm like, huh. And immediately bought it on ebook.
Because you could search that.
Exactly. So then it was great because I just had to figure out, just in quotes, had to figure out what I needed to search for and what words I needed to search for. And in a lot of cases, I mean, the online fan universe is so rich and so much that if I was searching for things like that I thought should be in the books and I couldn't find it, I could go online and someone else could point me in the chapter and page. So, the internet is an amazing place. But really, if there was ever any discrepancy between the show and the books, I talked about it. So I would say, well, in the books it says this, in the show it says this, I'm going to go with this. If it is something that's only, you know, that I could only get from the show, I mentioned that. And any of the dimensions are usually, like, if there's any numbers, it's as much as possible from the books. So yes, I did the whole time. I treated the books as kind of the source material, for at least 1 through 5, and then the show on top of that. But yes, you're right. That is the original source material, and anything I could do to use that, I did.
Yeah, that's a rich, diverse, near impossible to search world out on the internet, because I had thought that the Wheel of Time people had created their own little internet of information, but and it was like second only maybe to Lord of the Rings. And then Game of Thrones came along. I'm like, wow, okay.
It's amazing. And this was like writing this book, it was a lesson in restraint on the internet, which was I think one of the more valuable lessons I've learned in life, because there are so many people that are wrong on the internet, and so
and they don't care that they're wrong.
But they're so very wrong. So I'm like reading these forums and these questions, and people are asking science questions, and then people are answering so incorrectly. And it's one of those like, oh, I'm in a position to correct this person. And it's like, then finally I just had to stop, because I have no time for this, but people are so very wrong on the internet. So learning how to see something I disagreed with and say, well, that's a thing that's out there, and move along, was a great life lesson that I didn't expect, but I'm glad I learned.
Well, you go into some very deep dives about how the wall would have worked, and then you have this whole section of the physics of ice, and then you go into dragonfire and then wildfire and how these things, shall we say, mix or don't mix. So talk about the wall, and then we'll go over to fire. The science behind the wall. The wall was built how? Because I'm saying magic. I'm just saying magic.
Yeah, me too, actually. So yeah, chewing gum and magic. So ice is amazing. There's arguably 16 to like 90 different phases of ice. It's not just like your normal solid. We only see one type usually. But ice is something that seems like it should be a great building material. You stack it, igloos, we've seen this, like this should be fine. But the problem is that ice changes a little bit under pressure, and also it's not always completely solid. It is, because it can melt, it's always going to be moving a little bit. And in this chapter, I go a lot into like, what is ice? Because I think ice is fascinating. And also human history of trying to build with ice. So like, Martin wasn't the first person to think ice would be a great building material. And I was interested in what other times people might have wanted to use it. And it turns out that in World War II, which is a lot of science happened in World War II.
Yeah.
And I only talk about some of it. People really needed aircraft carriers and couldn't build them fast enough and didn't have material, and figured, hey, you know what? Why don't we just take an iceberg and hollow it out and make an aircraft carrier? And somehow this sounded like a fabulous idea then. They're thinking, we don't need this aircraft carrier long term. We have no money. We can do this. We'll just haul an iceberg, hollow it out. So someone's like, okay, well, let's get to work on that. And so a group started looking at how ice could be used as a building material. And what they found was ice was pretty strong. I mean, it was okay. It wasn't terrible. But the problem was they couldn't get ice to fail reliably. So sometimes ice would break at, a certain force, sometimes at another. It wasn't repeatable. And everything's going to hit a breaking point. Everything's going to break. And one kind of key to being able to engineer things is to know where that breaking point is very well.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with ice was it was there. We just were never sure where. And there was no kind of way to figure it out easily. And so they kind of were like, well, maybe this isn't going to work. And then someone figured out that if you mix ice with sawdust, it gets a lot stronger. So it became a compound called pycrete after the guy that figured this out, Pike. So pycrete, what they found is not only did it make it stronger when you mixed it with sawdust, it also made it fail more repeatedly. So they had more, they had an easier time. They had a more reliable material to be working with, more predictable material. And so they started going down this road of trying to build a berg ship, like a ship out of a sawdust iceberg. And what they found is it was what they needed, the specs they needed was just outside of what they were capable of. Particularly, they couldn't figure out a way to freeze enough water quickly enough for it to work. And so they were trying to push this, and then they ended up I can't remember historically what happened that they no longer needed the berg ship, but I did write about it. It's in there. I just can't remember now that I'm talking. and so they kind of abandoned that effort, and it was never really needed again. So this idea of building with ice was one that was explored. And I wanted to know, okay, so let's say you did build something with ice, what would it look like after 1,000 years? And I figured that really the best way, you know, I could maybe, I looked at a lot of papers about iceberg creep and glacial creep and glacial spreading and all of this. And while I was doing that, I realized that there was someone in who was a geophysicist, a glacier scientist named Martin Truffer. He's up at University of Alaska. Amazing guy. Also hilarious. And his grad students got him to do, he simulated the ice wall. So he took the equations that he uses to analyze glaciers and applied them to an ice wall with the dimensions that were described in the book. I think it's like 300 feet wide, 700 feet tall. And then let the simulation run over time to see what would happen to the ice wall. And as he said, like ice, and I think I have the exact quote in the book, but something along the lines of, ice isn't at all a building material. Ice is basically really big silly putty. So what happened is exactly, I mean, silly putty, you feel like you could build with it and then you try and it flattens. And that's exactly what would have happened to the ice wall. And then I was like, hey, but what about this thing called pycrete? And he started laughing. He's like, yeah, you know, at that size, there's no way sawdust is going to fix your problems. So he had not done simulations with pycrete, but he assured me that there was no need.
So. Yeah, that wall is pretty impressive, and it literally looks like a glacier that somebody like slid in half and just made the world, you know, the rest of the north behind it. It's a glacier. It's a slice of a glacier.
And the thing is, the equations are very clear that if it were really, really wide, it could be that tall. Like, you can have a sand dune of silly putty. Like, there are ways to have a something that tall. You just can't make, it's just not a wall. That's the thing. You can have that entire north be a glacier, but it's never going to be a very sharp wall. So, yeah.
The wall is magic. What about dragon fire and I guess the wildfire that plagued King's Landing.
So wildfire, that was interesting because I started by looking at really just like what were the things that everybody said wildfire could do and what can do them. And the idea of wildfire kind of floating on water, it's pretty much got to be petroleum-based. And there's an interesting story that actually led to, I think, the Clean Water Act. It was the Cuyahoga River. It was so polluted and had so much petroleum products and sludge just that was floating on the top that the actual river caught fire.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. I remember hearing about that in school. I'm like, burning rivers. Not good.
and luckily it led to change. But the idea of fire burning on water isn't too out there. The idea of Greek fire is that learning about that was interesting because much like many things and a lot like Damascus steel and Valyrian steel, it was supposedly like lost to history, how it was created. But it was also probably a petroleum-based product. And the bigger issue with that was making sure that it didn't also blow up your ship, because like when you are in a wooden ship and fighting people. You don't want your own ship blowing up. Mm-hmm. And so that made Greek fire so deadly wasn't necessarily that the actual material that was catching fire was so deadly. It was that they somehow figured out how to make like flaming weapons that didn't also light their own ship on fire. And that they were able to shoot Greek fire without also burning themselves. And that was the big like weapon, was the whole system, not just the fuel. So that was interesting to learn about. And really the one thing that has almost all the properties of wildfire, that like I think it's the closest real life thing to wildfire, is actually napalm. And that was, figuring out the science of napalm was really, really hard because of all the cultural sensitivities to it. And it, you can't, like, I, you know, am very much a pacifist in general, and I find myself on like the anarchist cookbook website because I can't find anything else on the chemistry of napalm. And I wanted to understand how it was made. I wanted, which like you can't, like it is, you get flagged for every TSA everything if your goal is to try and figure out how to make napalm.
Oh wow.
Yeah, oh my god. And I'm on every list. And the thing that made it difficult is because of the cultural sensitivities, I couldn't look up any information on it. And so like I had found a lot in various army records. I couldn't find anything. And what I finally figured out is that the term napalm is very loaded, but the term incendiogel isn't. So all the military has classified it all as incendiogel. And if I found that, I could find out a lot about the history of napalm. And so I was able to do that. And that is probably the closest thing to wildfire. The one issue is that it's not green. And so it's not hard to have wildfire or to have something that is as deadly as wildfire. The problem is to find something that is as visually stunning while it's killing you.
Okay.
So the idea of having something green was a wonderful visual twist, but that's really hard because only certain only certain compounds will burn green, and none of them are in most of the fire producing things. So if you had like, if you were able to somehow dope napalm with copper, it would be green, but making green wildfire is the hard part. Making wildfire isn't. So
and we still haven't figured out what Greek fire actually is for real.
No, not with any level of confidence from what I've seen.
There are theories, but no scientific accuracy.
Right. It's just hard because it's hard figuring out what made it so powerful. And a lot of people assume that the fact that it was so deadly and so kind of responsible for changing the tide of wars was the distribution system, not the actual fuel. And figuring out how to keep everything contained until you're ready to light it and shoot it was really the big engineering technology of the day, not what was actually burning. And so that was interesting too. I always thought Greek fire is like, kind of like, here is the thing that is flaming. And Greek fire is actually the entire system of how to shoot fire, not just the actual flaming thing. That was interesting to learn about.
That's something learned for me too.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the dragons and their fire, I was under the assumption, and this is just me being, you know, overanalyzing a TV show that I enjoyed and asking those silly questions when you can't fall asleep, you're going, huh, I wonder. We saw that Daenerys's dragons were different sizes because Drogon was free for longer. Viserion and I can't remember the other one were kept captive for a little bit longer, so they were smaller, but they eventually got free too. So I was under the impression that the dragons would have different volumes of breathing fire and possibly different temperatures because of their size difference.
Yep. So that is very true, actually. So one of the things that I talk about is I actually analyze clips of Drogon growing. So there's one of the first times you see him breathing fire and killing someone was season two when she killed, and I'm blanking on his name, while she was getting the Unsullied army.
Right. One master, right?
Yeah. And that first time that Drogon breathes fire, it's this very orangey fire. And it's not very hot. And then as you watch him grow in size, you can see his fire getting whiter and whiter. And so fire, you can tell the temperature based on the color. Mm-hmm. And the redder it is, the cooler it is. And the whiter it is, the hotter it is. And so as you watch Drogon grow up, you watch his fire get hotter. And that was really cool to watch. That was something that, like, I started in season two saying, hey, his fire is not hot enough to, like, melt stone. And then watching him grow up, that was, like, a thing I kept paying attention to. And by the time you see him in the fighting pits of Meereen, he's torching people with very, very white with fairly white fire. And so the idea that the fire gets hotter as dragons grow is whether or not the showrunners meant to do this, is there really is great evidence for that throughout the show. And that to me was fascinating, that size and flame temperature go together. And obviously volume is going to change depending, and that's going to be an issue depending on, there's a number of different ways you could talk about dragons potentially creating fire. And just holding the fuel is going to be a thing. So obviously, a bigger dragon is going to be able to hold more fuel and be able to torch more, the burninating. But I really did appreciate the fact that I could, in giving a talk, show a clip of Drogon when he's a baby and Drogon when he's, like, killing people and show that the flame temperature really did increase throughout the show. I thought that was a neat twist, whether or not they meant to do it.
Which brings me, in a roundabout way, to something you mentioned that you hated about the final season, and that Drogon could not melt the actual Iron Throne. Now, here's where I'm thinking. I was under the assumption that the throne itself was created by Beleriand's fire.
I actually did not. The thing is that this is not one I know really well, because I didn't look at the numbers for that. it wasn't, like, when I was doing this chapter, it wasn't a thing. Like, we didn't expect, I didn't talk about melting iron with Dragonfire. But the thing with fusing things together like that, it takes a lot less energy and a lot lower temp to fuse swords together to get them sticky than it does to completely melt them into a river of melt. Like, that's my thing. Like, I could see him heating it and having it fall apart, but having it into molten flowing iron is just not reasonable. So that's my problem.
What temperature would that have had to have been, and could any dragon have made it melt into a flowing blob?
So first off, it depends on the type of steel. Melting, like, steel, it's usually going to be about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, in that range. The thing is, he's just on the edge of it. But the problem with that is that when something melts, it's not just the energy to get it to the right temperature, which is, about where it needs to go. You also need to continue to add energy into it to break the bonds, to take it from a solid to a liquid. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about melting something, there's just two energies you need. That you need the energy to get it to the temperature where it would melt, and then you need the energy to break the bonds and make it melt. And that's one of the big problems. Like, melting a little bit to where you could, like, have things fall apart or where you could fuse things together is one thing. But melting it to the point of running on the, like, you know, in the throne room is just not, there's not enough energy. And that to me, there were a lot of times that I feel like George R. R. Martin just needs an intro physics class on how things melt. Like, that's what he needs, right? Because that's the one thing he can't get right is, guess what? The ice wall is going to melt if you try and build with it. Iron Throne's not going to melt and run everywhere. You've got when Ned's sword ice was melted down into Oathkeeper and Widow's Wale. There's the scene where, like, the Valyrian steel is completely melted and running, and it's, like, cast into this thing. And that's, like, not how you make a sword at all. Just starting base level idiocy, you're pouring a liquid to make a 3D object into a 2D mold. Like, that, no. So there's a lot of problems with that. When Viserys was killed with molten gold, that fire wasn't near hot enough to melt gold. And then we've got Drogon melting the Iron Throne. And then also, and this to me was interesting, and this is a scene I watched a million times, when zombie Viserion, even with blue fire, and blue fire is very, very hot, came in and kind of did like the like flyby of the wall.
Mm-hmm, and melted part of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if you look at the energy, even with blue fire, which is really hot, he would only have been able to melt in like about a meter because it takes that much energy to melt water or to melt ice. So he couldn't have even melted the wall, let alone Drogon melting a throne. it just drives me nuts because all of this, there's so much interesting, great science, and you just can't melt stuff like that. So it just baffles me how easily things are melted in the Martin universe. So
I like how you described it in the melting of the gold that killed Viserys. It's like the gold would not have would suffocate him. The clump of gold would have fallen out and crushed his head.
It would have. He would be just as dead.
Oh my goodness. So the chapters on regular steel and Valyrian steel, like I said, I have become slightly, I wouldn't say, enamored is the right way, with Forged in Fire on History Channel. Just
yes.
Watching these guys make these weapons. I think there's another one on El Rey Network starring Danny Trejo where they're making... They're specifically making blades and swords from swords and spears and other sharp-edged weapons from different movies, and that's a lot of fun because they actually get real stunt people in to test these things, and you see the forging process, you see the making, how they make it, and you see so many guys on Forged in Fire fail because they're trying to do Damascus.
Yes. Oh my God. So Damascus steel is one of the coolest things ever. And the interesting thing about, you will see people that say they can forge Damascus steel and that what they can make is, you know, it is Damascus steel. And at least the Forged in Fire episodes I've seen, and I've only watched a few. I picked out some of the Damascus steel ones. It's not real Damascus steel. It's welded steel. It's called like pattern steel or welded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it does the pattern, but not, and you have these beautiful blades with these beautiful patterns, but you don't have the properties that Damascus steel was known for. So the things that Damascus steel was known for was its ability to keep an edge, how sharp it was, how light it was. And those are things that people have really not been able to reproduce. Like, you can make it look like Damascus steel. Like, you can make it with those beautiful, like, ripples. You can make it look like that, but you can't make it behave like that. And for a long time, there were two competing metallurgy groups, physics, material science groups, trying to say they were the ones to forge Damascus steel again. And so one would publish a paper and the other would say, no, you're wrong, and publish a different paper. And they went back and forth for a long time. And what they found was that they could get reasonably close with a pattern. They could get reasonably close with a pattern that was like kind of eh, or really, really, really close, but with no pattern. And they couldn't quite figure out how to put it all together. And it came down to things like using the exact material that, like, using leaves from the same cave, and I think it was a cave, I can't remember, and using exactly the same things. And no one could quite understand how these trace elements from these very specific places really led to these incredible blades. Like, no one could figure out the mechanism. And so after years of these two groups going at each other, a group finally convinced someone to let them take an actual Damascus steel blade and image it. And what they found is that the process that the steel went through ended up creating carbon nanotubes on the edge. So it's not just that Damascus steel is a really well done type of steel. It is a phase of steel that is not seen anywhere else. And so it's carbon nanotubes around pieces of steel. And nobody's ever been able to recreate this. Anyway, when people try, they cannot get that carbon nanotube to form. And these people were doing it repeatedly, which to me is amazing. But one of the problems that makes it so difficult when people try with Damascus steel, like one of the things that leads to everyone failing, is that steel is an alloy of iron and carbon, and the more carbon it has, the more brittle it becomes normally. Like, that's normally the way it's supposed to be. And Damascus steel is about 2% carbon, which is a very, 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 very high carbon content. Other steel is like 0.1%. So it's a very high carbon content, and no one could figure out how anybody could work with that steel without it shattering because it's so brittle. But because that carbon isn't integrated in the same way, it's integrated as a nanotube, you're able to work with it, but it's because of how they managed to make the carbon form into this very specific type of carbon. And people still can't do it, but they at least know how it's done. So the forged in steel I've watched was always like welded steel that they call Damascus steel. And like, if you go on eBay, you can buy Damascus steel, except it's not real Damascus steel, it's this welded steel. The ones I've seen, I have feelings about, but trying to do it with the real method of Damascus steel, anything with that high carbon content is going to fail unless you're figuring out how to make it into these carbon nanotubes.
Wow. Another lost art disappeared in the mists of time. Interesting. So is that what gives Valyrian steel its power to kill the White Walkers?
I'm going to just assume Dragonfire was involved or something. the thing is, with steel, it gets very brittle when it gets cold. So steel is great for most things, but it is very, very, very brittle at cold temperatures, to the point that one of the reasons that the Titanic might have survived if it was in the Caribbean, because it would have dented the steel. It wouldn't have broken the steel. And so the hull wouldn't have been broken.
Wouldn't have failed, right? Okay.
Right. So steel gets very cold. So when normal steel shatters when a White Walker touches it, that's normal. Like, that's totally legit.
Mm-hmm.
No one's been able to convince an archaeologist to give them a Damascus steel blade to figure out the temperature. But carbon nanotubes don't have the same type of temperature dependence. So it's really possible that Damascus steel wouldn't have the same temperature dependence as normal, like, steel. So that whole getting cold and killing White Walkers, it may be that Valyrian steel's carbon nanotubes stop it from those problems. It might also just be the magic dragon fire.
Now, magic dragon fire also creates dragon glass, which, if I remember correctly, you said had a consistency much like obsidian.
Yes. So they actually refer to dragonglass as obsidian in the books, I think. It's used interchangeably in the books, I believe. But glasses in general are fascinating because they're basically molecular freeze tag. So normal solids, it's like, okay, we're going to, you know, if we've got water, we put it, you know, in ice cube trays and stick it in the freezer. You know, the molecules have time to like jostle around and sit where they want to, and you end up with an ice crystal. But glass, it's almost like it's flash frozen. So you go from, you go from molecules moving around and kind of in this liquid just being told to stop. And if anyone listening is into candy making, that's like the difference between like sugar candy and like toffee. Is the fact that, you know, toffee is basically sugar glass. You've got a liquid and it just stops without having a chance to form into a crystal. The thing with obsidian specifically is that It's very, very sharp when it fractures. So when Sam, you know, kills a White Walker with the obsidian, even if it did fracture in the cold, it would still be very, very sharp. And glass doesn't have that temperature dependence that something like steel does. So it's not going to get any more brittle as it gets colder. And I guess kind of in my head, like what my headcanon is that dragon glass is, you know, is obsidian that was created by heating up rock with dragon fire and then quenching it. So the dragon fire needed to be in there. But any glass, it's going to be like something's melted and then cooled very quickly. So I'm just going to assume that obsidian and dragon glass happened because dragons melted stuff. And then they cooled very quickly. But glasses really are fascinating. They're a completely different kind of solid. Like it's completely different than normal solids. And I always love the fact that like the sand crystals you see on the beach are molecularly identical to your window glass. They're just, the molecules are stopped in different ways. Yeah. And I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, when I started reading that with the obsidian, because I used to collect stones and crystals and stuff, and some of the coolest specimens I have a large globe, a large sphere of obsidian that if you just turn it in the light the right way, it has this undercoating of gold. And ooh. I have another one that has like a electric blue. And those are, I'm told those like gold sheen and rainbow sheen and blue sheen are kind of rare, but I thought they were just the coolest thing ever, so I got them. But I also have like pieces of earth that were glassed because of meteorite impacts. Like I got Egyptian desert glass, what they call it, and I've got some, what is it, that was moldavite. It's actually a very, very clear green sample because of how it melted and reformed after a meteorite hit there like hundreds of years ago.
Oh, that's so cool.
They are cool. And they don't feel like glass. They feel more like some sort of resin, like hardened, super hard resin. They don't feel like glass feels. And when I heard you talking about, you know, dragon fire made the dragon glass, I'm like, asteroid impact, very hot. Yeah, I could see that.
Exactly. And like at the Trinity bomb test site, there's pieces of trinitite, which are glass formed by atomic bombs. And it was the sand got melted, pulled up in water, cooled instantly and fell down. And it's a lot of it's green because of just the minerals. It's like the different colors are from different minerals in the, you know, in the soil or in the thing that was melted. But it's just like anytime you can melt something and cool it real quickly, you can end up potentially forming a glass. And it's just so interesting and so different.
The trinitite, is it radioactive?
Yeah, you don't
touch. Okay, yeah, okay. Leave it alone. Yeah. Just leave it. Yeah. Let it sit way out there and keep glowing. Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what you should do with it.
Well, I have one other question that probably belongs in the gruesome death chapter. You said nothing in the final season, season 8, is in this book, but this death that I'm thinking about was in season, I believe, 6 or 7, Mr. Bolton getting eaten by his dogs.
Oh, yeah. So I ended up, like, that was one. So there's a lot of death, right? Like, a lot. And honestly, so, yes, that was, I really actually enjoyed that one. that was fun.
Getting his comeuppance, it was a fun watch. Yeah, like,
I love that. But the thing with that, and the reason I didn't write about it, and it's one that people have asked me about, is there wasn't anything scientifically interesting about it. Like, you get your throat torn out, you're gonna die. And you're gonna bleed out. And to me, that wasn't necessarily as scientifically interesting. Like, I didn't have a question to answer. Like, poisons, it's really cool to understand molecularly, like, what they do to your body. And, you know, particularly with, like, the mountain, the fact that he was poisoned with manticore poison that was both necrotizing in that you saw it in the wound and you saw it kind of kill the area, which is a lot like brown recluse spider venom. Mm-hmm. And then also, it was systematic. Like, it was a systemic issue, which is a lot more like scorpion venom. And so it was interesting to see him poisoned with a thing that, like, that doesn't exist in nature. The idea of having a poison that's both necrotizing and systemic, like, that doesn't exist. So that was really interesting and very different. I thought that was cool. Hanging, it was fascinating to me because of all of how different it could be based on, like, one easy physics principle of, like, height and how different the experience could be as the person being hanged for over, like, a couple of inches. And that held some scientific interest for me. Mm-hmm. And that was another whole army, like, the army is very specific on how to hang someone.
Mm-hmm.
Including what songs should be played by the band. It's all very weird. And
is weird.
The things I found on the internet.
The beheading thing, the fascinating thing, I had no idea that France was still guillotining people in 1977. What?
I know. So it was like the last... Oh, and it was like the Star Wars movie came out in May. The last guy to be guillotined was in October. And then, like, Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell came out. Like, it was this insane. But to me, I found the guillotine, like, the history of the guillotine to be fascinating because so much of it was based initially on trying to find a way to humanely kill somebody. And it was created by someone that really didn't, that wanted to do away with the death penalty. And he was like, I probably couldn't get that to happen. So I figured the next best thing was kill people humanely. I'm like, well, okay, that's maybe one way. And then people just went the wrong direction with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up that, like, it was something about the number of executions really dropped off after they stopped being public executions. And it was almost like, oh, okay, well, yeah, we kind of lost our taste for this. We don't like people being killed. And to me, that was really interesting and very different than, like, the U.S.'s take on the death penalty, which is like, yeah, we definitely going to kill people. We're just going to do it really humanely in a way no one can, like, feel uncomfortable. And that's not a thing. And the kind of social aspect of all of these types of judicial killing was really weird. And then France just being like, finally saying, yeah, we can't stomach this anymore. But it was so much later. But in reality, of all the types of kind of judicial execution, the being beheaded is one of the tamer ones for the person experiencing it. It's always going to work. And it's going to do it very quickly. And there's not really anything else like that. And I am really anti-death penalty. And to me, it was fascinating that what we as society sees as a very gruesome way to die is absolutely, as far as I have seen, the most humane way. And that disconnect I find interesting. And we feel uncomfortable about it because of the blood and the gore, but that really, it just, the whole kind of interplay of that, like the one that we think is the most gruesome, is really from a brain perspective and consciousness perspective, the more humane. It was very weird to kind of get to that place. So it really made me, like, the things studying that chapter, it really made me realize is exactly how against the death penalty I am. I mean, not that it was in a lot of doubt, but still, but also how good Google is at flagging potential suicide risk was wonderful. And so Google still will send me, you know, because I'm trying to figure out how people die, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm doing searches that anybody else Google would flag as like a suicide risk. And I love that Google has been checking in on me ever since. Which is great, but
like
most
actually suggesting, hey, are you okay? Do you need to call someone?
Yeah, like if I search anything that's even mild, it didn't used to be this way, but like if I search anything that's like mildly in that direction, they're like, hey, by the way, the suicide prevention hotline is here. Just so you know, any death things that I searched on Google, the first result is always the suicide prevention hotline. it never occurred to me that that would be what they did, but I'm so glad. Like I really appreciate that Google does that. So that was interesting kind of seeing how other people treated my search for how to die. So, or like, you know, the effects of various methods of death. But yeah, padding was fascinating.
The machine learning is expanding in scary ways, but okay.
But it was good ways. Like,
yeah, that I will say that's a good way. That was a good way. So
well done, Google. Just didn't expect it.
Okay, so other than having issues with how the Iron Throne melted at the end, was there anything else that you didn't get to add into the book that you thought was a really cool question?
The thing is, not a really cool question necessarily. There's just ways that probably I could have enhanced what I already wrote, particularly like, you know, Drogon burninating the village for like, you know, all of that episode. And just things like I discussed ways that dragons could make fire, and I kind of could have expanded more on the fact that not only is making fire a hard thing, he really couldn't have done that. And I probably would have liked to do some calculations on the force of his fire, which I hadn't done and hadn't included because I hadn't really seen how his fire could topple buildings. And that was a departure because it talks about how Harrenhal, it looked like Harrenhal had melted. I thought that was awesome. And now we've got Drogon doing the same thing, and instead of melting, the whole city is crumbling. And I wish I had some way to kind of reconcile those two things. So destruction via dragon fire, destruction of cities and castles via dragon fire is something that I wish I had more time to explore.
Well, assuming that George actually writes those last two books, would his descriptions of what happened like be added in as an addendum, something you say, okay, revisiting this with new source material, here's what I think this could be, sort of thing?
I mean, publisher willing, sure. that's the thing. Like, I want to see, I mean, we all know how the show ended. I want to see what he's going to come up with and what the differences are. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. We might be waiting a long time.
Yeah, I know. I have my own issues with how that ended. And,
I'm okay with where it ended. I'm not okay with how it got there. Bran on the Iron Throne was dumb. But if I felt good about everything, then it wasn't really Game of Thrones. So I'll give them that. But
I'm not willing to give them all of that because Benioff and Weiss had 4.5, 5 books of material. And the material, the shows that they made, the episodes that they made from those books is wonderful. When they stopped having Martin's roadmap is when they started going back to literally, and I mean basic in a bad way, Hollywood tropes that they were familiar with. And the fact that they said in public that they hated fantasy and they were trying to remove the fantasy elements from them, I'm like, oh my God, I hope we never meet because I will punch you in the face a lot.
Yes, that I agree entirely. And
don't take a fantasy property and say, I'm going to take all the fantasy elements out of it because I hate fantasy. What is wrong with you?
Then you shouldn't be running the show.
Yes.
But it was a great show for a long time. And I've heard interesting commentary about how, you know, character driven versus plot driven. And really, if Martin said, this is where it's going to end, we're going to end with Sansa ruling the North, Bran on the throne, Jon is a wildling, and Tyrion is really running stuff, I would have been okay with that. Like, as long as Brienne is captain of I wanted her to be captain of the Queen's Guard, but as long as Brienne is captain of the King's Guard, done. I'm happy. So I'm not happy. I'm not unhappy with how it all ended. I'm just unhappy with how they got there. And it was rushed, and we didn't have all of those fantasy and all of that. Like, it felt like all of these things that we'd spent forever wanting to make something didn't.
Yeah, those last two seasons were rushed because they got petulant and they got butthurt about having their show, their pitch idea ripped to shreds and canceled by HBO. I mean, HBO wanted to give them 10 episodes for for season 7 and season 8. And they said, nah, we can do it with less. Who does that? Who in Hollywood does that?
It's the biggest own goal in TV history.
It's worse than that. It's worse than that. They intentionally made the ending of that unsatisfactory for, I'm going to say, 70% of the show's fans out there. They have now made it almost impossible for fans of the show to binge watch, rewatch that show again because they know how it ends. They have cost HBO so much money in rewatching those episodes. I am surprised HBO didn't see that play for what it was and just sick lawyers on them. And like, we're not going to just sick our lawyers on you. We're going to sick Microsoft lawyers on you. Get in that corner.
Yeah.
It's like, they were not great writers. They were average writers who adapted an incredibly written story. And then when it came for them, time for them to do it on their own, oh, it was a Casey Jones at the back swing and a miss. No, I'm not angry about that at all. Why do you ask?
And you're certainly alone in your feelings.
Oh, yeah, it's just me. It's all totally just me. But this book is fascinating. I would recommend it to any obsessed fan of Game of Thrones, anyone who's interested in material sciences, fluid dynamics of ice and fire, and just, you know, dropping large golden nuggets on people's heads.
Yeah.
And the biology of parasites in creating White Walkers.
That was fun.
That was just kind of gross because I have a thing with bugs and just yeah. The word parasite, you know, just kind of, that's a no for me. That's a no for me, dog.
Yep. Also, I hate raccoons now. I hate raccoons.
Oh.
Stupid little rabid trash pandas. I hate them.
But hey, that trash panda who climbed up a building just to chill out on a skyscraper window, you got to give him a golf clap.
Nope, probably rabid.
He was bored and hungry. Anyway, where can people find out more about your pop culture and media deep scientific dives in the future?
Probably best place is follow me at mathlete79 on Twitter and Instagram. And I will post fun updates, interesting physics facts, and where I'm going to be giving talks if you're interested in coming out and hearing me speak.
Excellent, excellent. The book is Fire, Ice, and Physics, The Science of Game of Thrones. Dr. Rebecca Thompson, thank you so much for indulging this geek roller coaster ride.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi. A lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast. Every week will launch you into an alternate reality, so buckle up. It's story time.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Rift Tracks, and you have bitten off a nice big chunk of Slice of Sci-Fi.
I love conversations that can go on for days because the topic is so interesting. Yeah, you have to check out this book. Fire, Ice, and Physics, The Science of Game of Thrones is really, truly one of those things that fans of a series who collect a lot of ancillary media, like books and books about the series, books about topics in the series, the way the old magazines used to in the 80s and 90s. this is one of those books. It's not very big, but it's very dense. And the additional topics that could be covered once the final volumes of the books in the series come out, I wouldn't mind seeing a volume two if MIT Press would be so interested. So yeah, check this one out. There are links on the website in the show notes. There are links to her Twitter and Instagram account. She's also an Ironman triathlete. So there's pictures from competitions, and she's a Hufflepuff fan. So you will see lots of photos of her in Hufflepuff garb at Harry Potter gatherings. So enjoy that. But yeah, this one, I would love to see her write more about this because she's just such a fascinating talker. There's a video on YouTube about a talk she did earlier in the year on the same book. I will include a link to it. I'll probably tweet the link to it, but definitely check it out if you have the time. So what things about Game of Thrones did you hate or love and are still inclined to talk about? Give us a call. The number is 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi through Apple Podcasts, through Stitcher, through Google Play Podcasts, through TuneIn, through iHeartRadio, and Player FM. And if you're subscribed to or listening through Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let people know that you are enjoying the show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. Follow along. Check us out. You can also ask questions there. I do engage in conversations with fans and visitors. I do retweet a lot of stuff from the Babylon Podcast Twitter account because Babylon 5 is airing on Comet TV, and I tweet a hell of a lot about Babylon 5 over there, especially since we have a few new shows in honor of the anniversary that have come out, so check those out. But where else are we? We're on Facebook, we're on YouTube, we're Slice of Sci-Fi in both places. I'd like to thank Neil for doing the Facebook updates for us, having a lot of fun over there. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, comment on this interview, on other interviews, on reviews that we've done of movies and TV shows, and check out other things for our fans and listeners to get engaged with. We have contests. Right now, there are 3 contests running. 1 for a DVD, 2 for books. You still have until, I believe it's midnight Pacific time, December 14th. So you got about a week left to enter that contest. We're giving away 2 copies of The Science of Rick and Morty. We're giving away 2 copies of Drawing Dragons and Other Fantasy Creatures. And we're giving away 6 copies of the Scary Stories documentary. Now, this isn't Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, the Guillermo del Toro movie. This is a DVD of the documentary of the books that movie was based on. Now, the books have, I think they rank as the most banned series of books in the past 30 years or something like that. That's a stat you can look up over on the ALA website. But yeah, they've been challenged, they've been banned record numbers of times, and this documentary is about one of those court challenges about the books. And if you look back in the Slice of Sci-Fi archives from earlier this summer, you'll see that I interviewed the director of that documentary, Cody Merrick. So we have copies of that documentary for you available in one of the 3 contests currently running for about another week or so. Follow the instructions, win a prize. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting the Slice of Sci-Fi Playground, which includes Slice of Sci-Fi, Writers After Dark, Babylon Podcasts, the archives for Charlie Jade, the archives for Dragon Page, which I'm trying to update to be mobile responsive and being compliant with Apple's new guidelines for podcasts. Yeah, lots of stuff to do. Not enough time to do it in. But if you would like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com. Patreon.com/sliceofscifi is the link where you can add your support by making a pledge, a monthly pledge that will get you in the bucket for perks. Every month I pick out a winner to get a perk, be it books, finished books, advanced reader copies that I have from Writers After Dark, or DVDs and Blu-rays that I get from Slice of Sci-Fi. These prizes are available because I can't keep all of this stuff. All of this stuff can go to new homes, and giving them out as giveaways is a fun way to do it for me, to show my appreciation for your support, for everything that I'm doing here and for all of the other shows. Thank you. And if a monthly pledge is not something you can commit to right now, that's okay. If you feel like donating every now and then, we have a PayPal link, paypal.me/sci-fi summer. Throw a couple bucks in that kitty every couple of months, once a year, twice a year, whatever you're comfortable with. Every dime helps. Every little bit helps. It helps keep the websites online. It helps keep the media archives online. All of that. So thank you very much for everyone who is supporting and to everyone who is considering supporting. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. And we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.